Sony.
Hello, Canada. Today's date is February 25th, 2024. Welcome to a full edition of Canadian Common Sense, Canada's Issues, in about an hour. It is Tony in Saskatchewan, flying solo today. Lewis is away, so you will be stuck listening to some Prairie Boys rantings for about an hour. So, got a lot going on today. Let's start off with a ton of housekeeping items, actually. I got quite a few going on. This past Monday was Family Day in much of Canada. Ontario, Saskatchewan, Alberta all celebrated Family Day. BC, I believe, was, if it was not Family Day, it was BC Day. There was definitely a holiday. Manitoba decided to join in on the fun. I mean, it was already Louis Riel Day in Manitoba. But Wab Kinew, Premier of Manitoba, made good on his promise to recognize Louis Riel as Manitoba's first premier, and did so on this past Monday. There is now a portrait of Louis Riel in the Manitoba legislature, recognizing him as Manitoba's first premier. So I guess that would make him also Manitoba's first Indigenous premier. So now Wab Kinew actually takes that title away from himself. And fine, I mean, I had said before, I'm absolutely fine with that. So Louis Riel Day is now a holiday. Louis Riel is now an official Manitoba premier. What I didn't think was so hot is Louis Riel. Wab Kinew also talked about Louis Riel being one of the fathers of Confederation. No, Freda can't go that far with you, Mr. Kinew. That's just not necessarily a father of Confederation. Father of the province of Manitoba, absolutely. Very important figure with the Red River settlements, but not a father of Confederation. Also in Manitoba, Wab Kinew, the premier, also said that Orange Shirt Day, Truth and Reconciliation Day, September 30th, will now be a statutory holiday provincially in Manitoba as well. It's already a federal stat, so for those who are federally regulated employees, it's a stat holiday already. And, well, now that's a little more than half the country as far as the number of provinces are concerned who now recognize Truth and Reconciliation Day as a provincial stat. And, well, go ahead, I guess. I mean, that makes BC, the four maritime provinces, and now Manitoba is on board. So eventually it's going to end up being a stat day, you know, a provincial stat day, I should say, nationwide. And, well, Lewis has already spread his opinions about that. As a small business owner, you've got Labor Day in September. 3 weeks later, you've got Truth and Reconciliation Day, another stat. And then 2 weeks after Truth and Reconciliation Day, less than 2 weeks, most of the time, you have Thanksgiving, another stat holiday. So that costs business owners an awful lot of money because it's a paid day off. And if someone works that day, well, then you've got to pay them that regular pay, plus you're paying them whether it's time and a half or double time. And if you're unionized, who knows, it could be even more than that, especially if it falls on a weekend. So, well, is what it is, I guess. But yep, I do see that coming. And, well, that's just, I guess that's just how it's going to be. All right, so let's go over to the East Coast for a second here. Nova Scotia announced, I would say a few years too late, but finally, the Nova Scotia Health Authority has said, okay, we are no longer going to require proof of vaccination for our employees or for candidates, new hires, etc. Thought, well, it is 2024, and it's been, well, 4 years since, almost exactly 4 years since the pandemic was declared. So I guess thanks for jumping on board. It most definitely is time to allow those who don't want to show proof of their vaccinations to keep their job or get a job. So great. Honestly, someone's personal medical history, which is what vaccinations fall under, is nobody's business but yourself and your doctor. So as far as I'm concerned, no employer should ever have had the right to ask for that in the first place. So thanks a lot for coming on board, Nova Scotia. Note, the other coast, British Columbia, still hasn't got on board with that idea, so I'm not even taking too big a shot at you, Nova Scotia. Maybe BC could get on board as well. Wouldn't that be nice? All right. Staying in Nova Scotia, listener Jess sent in a Facebook message saying when we were talking about land use bylaw changes or provincial law changes when it comes to British Columbia, she had written in and said, you know, actually that they had, her local municipal council had tried something like that. She lives in small town Nova Scotia and said that municipally there was talks about changing the land use bylaws and the exact same language, animal units per square kilometer, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, well, that was going to be a little tough on hobby farmers and homesteaders if those laws had gone through. Thankfully, the citizens were at least alerted beforehand that these changes could be coming and were able to get together and make certain that the bylaws did not pass. And, well, honestly, Jess, I'm really happy for all of you out there. And that's kind of how it has to be, is that we the people have to speak up. And really, the most accountable governments are your local municipal governments, because they are the governments that is closest to you. So that's where it's going to have to happen. So I'm glad that that folks in Nova Scotia were able to, at least in your municipality, were able to step up and make certain that did not happen. That has been the case in a few of the counties in Alberta and Saskatchewan that I was referring to in the last episode as well, is once the people actually see what's happening, they, well, pretty easy, especially in rural Canada, it's very easy to see how much damage such policies can do. So keep it up. Be vigilant. Proud of you all. All right. So let's move back to the other side of the country, right into the middle of the country. Actually, let's go and we'll deal with listener Trevor. So on the last episode, during housekeeping, I had said, if I ever meet Trevor, he's probably going to punch me right in the face because he and I taunt each other a lot about the Pierre Poilievre-Maxime Bernier dichotomy. Well, Trevor wrote in and said, hey, guys, look, I would never be violent toward you or Lewis. And I thought, well, yeah, okay, Trevor, you know, that sounds like something a violent person would say. So I better be careful regardless. If you happen to be where we are for Grey Cup 25 in Winnipeg, well, you know, I'll make certain I got Lewis to protect me. Sorry, Trevor. Got to have some fun with you. All right. Now let's go to the West Coast, to BC. We were talking about the land use changes. Government of BC has said, you know what? We're going to put these land use changes on hold for right now. And we are going to try them again when we can convince people living in BC that it's more of a good thing. Okay. I stressed people living in BC, because for some reason, the BC government has decided now that if you call people living in BC British Columbians, that is offensive, because not everybody who lives in BC might identify as a British Columbian. Thinking, of course, of First Nations people and of new immigrants who might still define or identify as Chinese or Nigerian or what have you. The whole idea behind this country, this cultural mosaic that exists in Canada, is to unify us behind some kind of centralizing idea, some kind of core identity. I know Justin Trudeau said we don't have that, but we do. It's called being Canadian, being a British Columbian because you happen to live in British Columbia. Being a Nova Scotian because you live in Nova Scotia. Being a Newfoundlander because you live on the rock. I mean, this is not rocket science, folks. You live in this country. You are a person of this country. I don't understand why it is that the woke left, and yes, that's what the BC NDP government is. It is the woke left. I don't get why the woke left wants to tear this country apart the way they do. They, I mean, it's not just the country. They want to tear apart all the institutions within this country as well. And, well, we're going to keep talking about that onward and onward and onward, unfortunately. So, yes, to all people living in BC, a.k.a. British Columbians, you are safe from provincial land use changes for the time being. But again, as I said about our friends in Nova Scotia, be vigilant because you never know when they're going to bring it back in. They just have to convince you now that it's a good thing. Well, good luck with that. You've got people like us who will actually bring it to you straight, who have seen the attempts to make these land use changes. And, well, we'll just keep informing you exactly what a poor idea that is and be happy to do it. All right, a couple more housekeeping items. We have got GC Strategies. My apologies, last episode I had said it was called GC Services. Oops, the company that is behind the Arrive Scam app was called GC Strategies. Fun fact about GC Strategies, the company was founded in 2015 by those two dudes in Ottawa who had worked for a different firm from 2010 till 2015, which had got a few government contracts, so perhaps they kept the contacts that they had got those contracts from. And what do you know, once Justin Trudeau became prime minister, those two dudes absorbed that other company into GC Strategies, who has since got, well, $258 million in government contracts. And they pocketed, well, so far that we know of, they pocketed $19 million from the Arrive Scam app. But, well, we don't get to find out how much more until there's an inquiry, I guess, because the committee that was investigating Arrive Scam in Ottawa, in Parliament, got shut down. Big surprise, because the Liberal, NDP, and Bloc all voted to shut the committee down because they found testimony, or documentation, I should say, they found documents that were, quote, scary, and did not want that revealed to the public. What did they find that was scary? I have no idea. I'm just as in the dark as you folks are, and will probably continue to be that way unless they can revive the committee. Speaking of another reason why we need an election now, there we go. It's ridiculous that, well, it's, I guess everybody's ganged up on the Conservatives to make certain that the committee got shut down, which is, well, pathetic to say the least. But what can we do when we're in the minority situation? Those who want to get to the truth apparently are just being shut down, because why would we want to do that? Okay, so listener Eric had emailed in and just said, hey, can you tell us a little more about yourself? And I thought, well, not that I'm that interesting, but sure, I can tell you a bit about me. I think a lot of you who listen to the show already know much of my life story, but yeah, I'll give you a few personal details. 52 years old, drive trucks for a living, just locally around Saskatoon. I've lived in Saskatoon for just over 20 years, and I grew up in a small community in Alberta. You're going to hear more about that on the show, actually, just coincidentally enough. And, well, I'm on marriage number two. My wife is absolutely amazing, fantastic woman. So the second time was definitely a charm for me. And, well, what else do I say? I love classic cars and rescue cats. There's six rescue cats in our home, and we've had as many as nine at times, but six is a good number. Maybe we'll, if the herd culls itself somewhat through age, maybe it'll drop. But yeah, they always seem to show up just when we think that the herd is starting to shrink itself. So yeah, that's really about it about me, and I'm really much more interesting than that, other than little fun facts you will hear as we go on through the show. Lewis and I have been friends for over 25 years now. We actually met at a Edmonton Eskimos game. He and I had season tickets in the same section, and being that we were both quite young, we were, you know, loud and proud when cheering for our teams. He was a BC Lions fan, well, born and raised in BC as he was and lives there now, of course. And I was a Saskatchewan Rough Riders fan even back then when I was living in Alberta. So we would have a lot of fun bantering back and forth when ever our respective teams were in town, and just ended up being friends and had an interest in politics, which, you know, was a good bonding feature right off the bat. And that's actually what ended up starting this show, is we continued to talk politics with one another and finally decided, well, maybe we should just make a show, which actually was Lewis's idea. And we originally, the idea was just we were going to, well, just have the show to talk politics with each other one, and then kind of assume he and I would be the only ones who ever listened to the show. And then, well, what do you know? Some other people decided that they would listen in as well. And fantastic. We're happy to have them. So, yeah, that's really all about me that I can really tell. So one more housekeeping note to talk about is listener Corey, who happens to be a personal friend of mine, grew up together in that small town we'll be discussing later in the show, who also happens to be a Canadian Armed Forces veteran. So, Corey, thank you for your service. Sent an article from Global News talking about the 15-minute cities, and it doesn't want to open here, so I'll just have to summarize. I won't be able to quote the article directly. Talking about the 15-minute cities and saying that, oh, the city of Edmonton wasn't talking about constricting anybody or confining anybody to a 15-minute city. It was simply a discussion about the concept of making work-life balances more accessible in your local communities within Edmonton. And, well, we don't buy it for one thing, because that's just kind of how our conspiratorial nature is. But what I thought was hilarious was that it talked about all the conspiracy theories around 15-minute cities and the conspiracy theories around the Wuhan virus and wildfires, etc. Well, just as so happens to be, again, thanks, Corey, for sending that in. Well, a 54-year-old woman in the Cold Lake area was actually charged with over 30 counts of arson for wildfires that happened to take place in the Bonnyville, Cold Lake, Alberta area. But we were told last year that was climate change that was the cause of all those fires. Oh, it was climate change. And I'd quoted at the time Vashi Capellos on her radio show saying, yeah, let's talk about the root cause behind all these fires, and that's climate change. Well, turns out as a journalist, she got her facts wrong, because, well, no, it was not climate change. And, you know, we don't actually know it on the show last year, and Danielle Smith herself had said in the media, it was a very early start to the wildfire season in Alberta last year. And what do you know? It was right as the election was called in the spring that the wildfire started. And of course, we talked about that on the show, saying that does seem a little strange that wildfires started right as the election started. And there were some bad ones, especially to the west of Edmonton. And well, turns out there's a ton of arson charges as a result of investigations by the RCMP on all of these wildfires. How about that? I gotta call this article out as well, talking about the quote-unquote conspiracy theory that the Wuhan virus was created in a lab. And yes, I continue to call it the Wuhan virus. I know it's COVID-19. And if you're Scott Moe in Saskatchewan, you will call it COVID-19 like you're reading it off a piece of paper for the first time, because that seems to be how he always says it. It's COVID-19, so that all of us, you know, dumb peasants will understand what he's saying. But we brought it to you 4 years ago, or almost 4 years ago, that indeed it appears that this was developed in a lab. And so I just got to call you out, Global, again, because I'm really tired of all your fake news, that we brought it to you almost 4 years ago that the Chinese government had cordoned off the area around the Wuhan lab where the virus was created and leaked. And U.S. military satellite footage had shown cell phone pings were all outside of this area around the lab, but none right by the lab itself, because that area had been quarantined. Then, of course, we talked more about, well, it could not have come from the wet market. I mean, the bat virus is what they tried to call it. They even tried to pin it on quote unquote raccoon dogs for a while. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but that was in the, I believe it was the fall of 2020. They were like, oh, well, it must be the raccoon dogs. Well, that story blaming the raccoon dogs, that rose and fell in the media within a span of a couple of weeks. So if you don't remember the raccoon dogs, you're definitely forgiven. But the bat thing, oh yeah, they talked about being a bat virus. It was came from bats. And I thought, well, that just didn't add up. And then when you started to look, it was like, oh, look at that. The NIH and the National Institute of Health in the US was actually funding the Wuhan lab to work on gain of function research for a SARS-CoV virus, which just happened to be the Wuhan virus that was released. And it just so happened that this virus had certain qualities in it that just did not exist in nature. I've gone on many times about a double arginine CGG strain in the virus that does not occur in nature and therefore would have to be inserted in a laboratory environment. Then, of course, we could also talk about the scientists in the Winnipeg Virology Lab that were what marched out the door, who just happened to be working with the Chinese Communist Party and the Wuhan Virology Lab, sending samples to them. We could also talk about the fact that the Chinese government had applied for a patent for a vaccine for a SARS-CoV-2 virus in February of 2020, just before the Wuhan virus escaped from the lab in Wuhan, during the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations. And we talked about that at the time too, that isn't it funny? The virus was released, the Lunar New Year celebrations went on, they allowed people to disperse from Wuhan to wherever else they were going in China and around the world, right after the military games took place in Wuhan, and the obviously military participants all again dispersed to fly home around the world. And then and only then did they shut down the city of Wuhan because of this virus that just happened to leak out of a lab. And of all the things, all the people, I should say, John Stewart, who nobody can ever accuse of being some kind of right-wing fringe conspiracy theorist, who, former host of The Daily Show, had a rant with when he was on with Bill Maher a couple of years back, saying, the name is right on there. It was the Wuhan Virology Lab. It's the virus created in Wuhan. And I just said, yeah, buddy, thanks for getting on board. That's what we were saying right from the start. So global news, take your conspiracy theory and, well, shove it right up your you-know-where, because it's not a conspiracy theory when you can actually prove that that's where it happened. And just so happens that the Eco Alliance and NIH are still funding research in Wuhan on gain of function for who knows what other viruses. But there's more to come. That much we do know. There is definitely more to come. So, all right, that was a lot of housekeeping. Thanks for hanging out with us on that. So we've got a lot to talk about on the show today. So on the show today, PharmaCare deal, small town Alberta, national recognition, Chrystia Freeland hikes up the debt, and more. So why don't we actually start right in that small town in Alberta that happens to have gotten some national, even international recognition, for, well, absolutely ridiculous reasons. The town of Westlock, Alberta, and just happens to be a town that I know very well because that's where I grew up. I went to high school in Westlock, Alberta, graduated in 19, never mind, before some of our listeners were even born. And, well, I know the town well. There was, I know the issue. I haven't lived there for the better part of 30 years, probably even a little bit more than that. But I definitely still keep in touch. My best friend lives there. to this day, just outside of town. I still know people who live in town, so I'm definitely still connected to my hometown of Westlock, Alberta. So what did the evil town council in Westlock, Alberta do to earn themselves this national notoriety? They actually just observed the democratic process. Here's a little bit of background. So the local public high school there, R.F. Staples Secondary School, which is where I graduated from way back when, the R.F. Staples Thunder Alliance, which is their gay straight alliance, that club did not exist when I was in school at any rate. Corey, you're welcome to fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure we did not have that back in those days. But yes, they had a gay straight alliance, the Thunder Alliance. I'm guessing because the sports teams in the school are called the Thunderbirds, so that's probably why it's the Thunder Alliance. But at any rate, the Thunder Alliance had done some fundraising and painted a crosswalk with the pride flag, or actually that would be the Progress pride flag colors, stylings, onto a crosswalk in the downtown area of Westlock. Westlock is a town, by the way, of roughly about 5,000 people, and it's roughly an hour north and west of Edmonton, just so you've got an idea where we're talking about. So the Thunder Alliance at R.F. Staples painted a pride flag on a crosswalk, which caused some controversy in itself, which they do wherever you go. So it's not just a bunch of redneck Albertans getting upset about one of them pride flags. There was a group that was called the Westlock Neutrality Team, who I guess formed to discuss this pride flag on the crosswalk. And just they petitioned the local town council for a bylaw to, I guess, just get some clarification, because there were people who didn't really feel like crosswalks should be used for political statements, I believe. That's not exactly the wording, but that was kind of the gist of it, and the genesis of it was just that, are we really going to use our own town infrastructure to forward political and social justice causes? So a petition was created. Enough people signed it that town council had to look at the issue. And so then council created a bylaw, which led to a plebiscite. And this plebiscite, 1,300 people voted in the plebiscite. The results were very, very close, 663 to 639 in favor of the bylaw. I'll actually put that bylaw up on our Facebook page after the show. I did take a screenshot of it that I'd gotten from X, so I'm hoping that it's accurate. It certainly reads that way. So, and there is a webpage you could go to for, I believe it's just westlock.ca, that you can actually look that up on your own too. But I'll put the screenshot up. And so what it was they had the very close vote, but the vote was in favor of the bylaw. Now, you're hearing in the lamestream media all across the country that the town of Westlock has now banned pride flags to be flown on municipal buildings and banned the pride flags on crosswalks. And the town banned nothing. What the town did was clarify its bylaws to say that, well, I'm just going to read them out here. It's Westlock Bylaw 2023-14, Section 3, Crosswalks and Flags. So 3.1, crosswalks will only be painted in the standard white striped pattern between two parallel lines, right? So you've got your two stripes that normally people walk through, and sometimes they'll draw the little angled lines through them as well. But at any rate, that's it. The two white stripes and whatever other white stripes they want to put in the middle. 3.2, only the National Flag of Canada, Provincial Flag of Alberta, or Town of Westlock flags are raised on flagpoles on public properties or facilities, right? So basically anything that's a provincial building or town shop or town office, for example, only have those flags. All right, and those three choices, I should say, the Canada, Alberta, Town of Westlock. Again, fair, neutral, not promoting any single kind of cause. All right, 3.3, there will be no decorations on town crosswalks or displaying of flags supporting political, social, or religious movements or commercial entities. So local grocery store can't, quote unquote, buy a crosswalk and put their logo on it. That's fair. I don't really need to see a Shoppers Drug Mart logo on a crosswalk as an example. And that could be a really bad precedent because then suddenly all of your crosswalks are owned by somebody. I don't have a problem with standards on crosswalks. The reflective white paint is actually a good thing because then you can actually see it and ideally see people on it with a little bit of contrast. If the white, then whatever color the person's wearing, I guess if they're also wearing white, you just would see more white walking across the crosswalk. Ooh, horrible. All right. So 3.4, no grandfathering of any existing crosswalks or flags that contravene this bylaw will be authorized. That is what the social justice warriors are using to say that these pride crosswalk is banned because, oh, well, that means that if there's already there, it's got to be taken down. Yeah, that's the idea. We're looking for uniformity here. And I know because Benita Peterson was involved with Westlock Neutrality, and she was kind of a controversial figure. She was very, very outspoken against the Wuhan vaccine mandates and, well, the whole vaccination campaign, period. And for that, she got labeled a conspiracy theorist and all the same kind of labels that we get, denialist, denying the science, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't have to go into the details because you've heard that enough from everywhere over time. So, and of course, Benita was a former organizer with that group Take Back Alberta. And if you've heard the lamestream media talking at all about Danielle Smith, that is always their tagline. Oh, she's just catering to Take Back Alberta, and Take Back Alberta owns the UCP, and Take Back Alberta is got Danielle Smith elected leader, etc. Everybody in the lamestream media is giving Dave Parker and Take Back Alberta way more credit than they deserve. And of course, they're doing it because they want to paint Take Back Alberta as some kind of racist, extreme, far-right organization, and now they own the UCP in Alberta. No, Take Back Alberta is a very successful grassroots organization, and part of their shtick is they do try to infiltrate political parties, and they do indeed try to influence policy or the direction of said political parties. But if you really think that Take Back Alberta owns the UCP, and if you really think that Take Back Alberta is actually running the government right now, you're probably giving them a little more credit than they deserve. There are grassroots organizations like this in every province, by the way. So if you want to make the case that every government in Canada provincially is owned by one of these grassroots organizations, well, now who's being the conspiracy theorist? Let's just leave it at that. So I've seen a lot of hate on X for Westlock right now. And I'm also seeing a lot of love for them and a lot of shout outs saying, good for you, Westlock. It is good for you, Westlock. I'm actually quite proud to say that's my hometown. They'd actually just decided to stand up for common sense and say, nobody, it gets to be political with our town infrastructure, nor should they, because if you're going to have a pride flag crosswalk, as an example, since that's what this is about, that you don't need to have your town council staff, etc., being allegedly seen to be supporting that particular issue of pride. Or maybe there is a maybe there's a swastika crosswalk somewhere and they don't want to be seen to be supporting the swastika crosswalk. Yes, that's an extreme case. It would never happen. But it's okay to get ridiculous because that's exactly what's going on here. And just like I said earlier, they don't need to be seen to be supporting a Shoppers Drug Mart crosswalk, you know, or any group. So, no, it's good. You laid down the rules and just said, look, we are out of this. This is what our crosswalks will look like. This is what our flagpoles will look like. If you want to put a pride flag on your home, knock yourself out. You want to paint your driveway with pride flag colors? You do you. They've just said, we as a town are not going to get involved in political or social justice issues. I see nothing wrong with that. And hopefully this is the only 15 minutes of fame Westlock gets because, well, it's really just a simple council decision to make this bylaw plebiscite, and it passed. So moving on, at least hopefully we all are able to move on from this. Good job, Westlock. There you go. Now, folks, now you know where I'm from. It's great town to be from now. I'm quite proud to say good job, guys. Okay, let's talk a little bit about PharmaCare. Well, the PharmaCare deal has been done. No, it hasn't. Jagmeet Singh is doing all the media rounds, talking about the PharmaCare deal that has now been struck between his party and the Liberal government. It's funny, Jagmeet Singh is the only one talking. The Liberal part of the coalition is saying, oh, no, we're not going to say anything until the legislation is actually passed. So, kind of like Obamacare back in the day. Remember Nancy Pelosi saying you have to pass it to find out what's in it? I got a funny feeling that's exactly what you're going to find out about this PharmaCare bill, is that they have to pass it before we find out what's in it. Jagmeet Singh has given some hints already, and I'm actually not even opposed to some of what Jagmeet Singh has said. What he has said is there's going to be universal coverage, and that was one of his big things. Had to be universal coverage, had to be single payer. Well, that part, the single payer part, hasn't really meted itself out yet. That he's been kind of quiet on that part. He has said that, yep, now there's going to be full coverage for diabetics. And, well, maybe not completely full coverage for diabetics, but insulin will be covered. A wide range of insulin, sorry. So it might not be all insulin, but a wide range of insulin and treatments for type 1 and type 2 diabetes will be now covered under this PharmaCare plan. I should say now covered. The implementation will be into the future. So I'm sure, at least I hope, there will be an election before implementation or even a PharmaCare bill passes, for that matter. So what I did not see was needle coverage for type 1 diabetics, for example. I know a lot of diabetics, at least one of my niece, who is a diabetic, has a pump, and it just, you know, she just has it attached to her. And a friend of mine is the same thing. So I don't know how many diabetics still use needles, but I'm sure there are a lot. And I used to curse about that, and so does my friend who now has a pump. Used to curse that he had to pay for his needles, yet drug addicts would get them handed to them. And I said back then, like 15 years ago, why would a government not just give the needles to diabetics on an exchange basis so that they're not handing free needles to drug dealers? So the government does enough of that on their own anyway, but that's another story. But I did not see that here. I'm sure that there probably is some provision in there. Actually, I don't know that, but I mean, I'd like to see some provision in there for that. But yes, a quote unquote wide range of insulin for diabetics. And contraceptives, of course. I mean, you can't have PharmaCare without contraceptives because that should be part of any PharmaCare plan, right? I've got a lot of opinions on that. I'm sure Lewis does too. So anyway, this it'll work a lot like what they do in British Columbia right now for on the contraceptive side anyway. So, example, intrauterine devices and prescriptive contraceptives, which would be like birth control pills, for example, and, quote, emergency contraception, which is like the morning after pill, for example, will all now be covered under this universal pharmacare plan. I don't know if that's something I really necessarily agree with, especially the morning after pill part. You may want to try and teach your citizens at least a little bit of responsibility, maybe a little bit of morality. I mean, what would be so wrong with that? And maybe that instead of having the unprotected sex and just having the morning after pill, maybe you could try to be a little bit more responsible. I don't know. I mean, I'm not necessarily opposed, but I really think that if you're going to start covering something right away, Mr. Singh, maybe that's not the horse you want to march in on. Maybe you'd want to march in on saying, and we've got cancer drugs covered. But I heard nothing from him about any cancer drugs covered, for example. But on that subject, New Zealand has a government-funded pharmacare program, as do many progressive countries in this world, some in Europe as well. But let's just stick with New Zealand, because that's something I've actually read about, that New Zealand has a universal single-payer prescription pharmacare program. And, well, because the government says, we are only willing to pay X number of dollars for these particular treatments, these particular drugs, a lot of pharmaceutical companies have said, okay, well, that's fine, but we're not going to sell you the latest drugs that we have, the our newest medications. So what the PharmaCare plan covers in the case of New Zealand is about 10% of cancer drugs, for example, because all the newer, more innovative cancer drugs are more expensive and the government won't pay for them. So sure, yeah, we as a government will provide you, the citizens, with cancer drugs, but they're all ones that are about 10 years old and ones that are not as effective because, of course, they haven't got, well, all the latest research in them. So there's that. There's that that worries me, that when the government says, yeah, we're only going to pay X number of dollars, and that's what they do. I mean, and to be fair, all insurance plans are like that. I mean, all insurance plans, even the private sector insurance plans, will, like the one I'm on, for example, with Sun Life, they tell the drugstores, you know, look for generics first if you find, you know, to fill whatever prescription it is. So it's not just the government plan, but we have said so many times on this show, whenever government gets involved in something, they ruin it. And that's exactly what's going to happen here, is they will ruin it because they will take away your choice. And when they take away choice and government starts to ration out the care, like they do with the healthcare system now, they're also going to start rationing out the medications. All right. So let me just tell you what Justin Trudeau has said. Justin Trudeau says, and I have to quote him, of course, in a wealthy country like Canada, nobody should have to choose between buying groceries or buying much needed medication, end quote. Wow, that's profound. And you're absolutely right. Nobody should. And 80% of us don't, because 80% of Canadians already have some form of drug coverage, whether it is through your company benefits or your union, for example. 30% of Canadians work for a union. So it might even be higher in some provinces, but that's the rough average. It's about 30% of people work in unions who have a benefit plan, which includes drug coverage. I work in a private sector company that has company benefits, including drug coverage. 80% of Canadians have that coverage, and the lower income Canadians also have coverage through a government plan right now. So, and Bill Morneau had talked about this years ago. Remember when Bill Morneau was finance minister and this came up? He even said, we're only talking about 20% of Canadians that don't have adequate drug coverage. All right, so there's still some coverage. So when Justin Trudeau says we should not have to choose between buying groceries and buying medications, he's full of it. It's a good talking point, and the lamestream media will carry that water for him for all the way to his house from the river. I mean, they'll be happy to do it because it forwards, well, I guess his needs, because he needs to paint those who would be against pharmacare as the bad people. Like me, I'm one of those bad people. I don't really think we need a universal pharmacare plan. There we go. I'm on the record. So here's the worst part. Now, Jagmeet Singh has said, yep, they've made references to including this in the Canada Health Act, which means that provinces will have no choice but to abide by it if they want to receive any health transfers. I'll get into that one right away. And it's going to cost, here's the greatest part, it is going to cost $40 billion a year. And we put that up on our Facebook page when we talked about the announcement. Just said, here's your $40 billion, Canada. That's every year. It'll actually cost more because, of course, they'll have to hire yet more bureaucrats. The size of the civil service, by the way, has increased by 50% since Justin Trudeau has been in charge. In the COVID times themselves, they went up exponentially. Let's just see if I can find the figure for you, just in case I'm wrong, which I don't think I am. So let me just go into here to download said chart. And of course I can't find it, because when I bring that screen up, it gives me absolutely nothing naturally. But suffice it to say, our civil servants has grown exponentially since you-know-who took charge. And it's been, I know it's in the range of 50%. It's huge. It's absolutely huge how much our civil service has grown. And it's disgusting. One-third of Canadians currently work for government at one level or another. And, well, that tells you right there why it is that 54% of government spending, as a national average, is spent on salaries for one level of government or another. And so that means that's your provincial, municipal, etc. representatives. That's awful. That is absolutely awful. So when you want to say that pharmacare is going to cost $40 billion, that's always, I mean, well, as we've seen with the Rive scam, I mean, the government might say 40, but it's going to end up costing 80. And don't know how exactly you afford that when you've already got, well, minimum $40 billion deficit for this fiscal year alone. Remember in the fall economic update, Chrystia Freeland had increased the projected debt, or deficit, I should say, because first it was going to be about 32 or 36 billion dollars, and then it was like, actually it's going to look more like about 46 for this fiscal year. So you want to add pharmacare on top of a $46 billion deficit, so you want to add another $40 billion, and you're talking about increasing spending to the military, which they won't do. I mean, they cut $1 billion, but they want to keep pretending they're going to spend more money on that. So where does the money come from? Well, glad you asked that question, Tony. Where does that money come from? Let's talk a little bit about Chrystia Freeland and her latest antics, because, well, she's going to help us understand where that money comes from. And you are not going to like this one, Canada. So Chrystia Freeland, and this was announced in Blacklock's Reporter, so I decided to do a little bit of journalism and go through some of the statutes that the government of Canada can utilize. And I'm going to be honest, I actually felt a little sick to my stomach when I read through these statutes. So I'm going to highlight a bit of that for you. So what has Chrystia Freeland done that is, well, a little unnerving? It's been reported in a couple of different outlets that she has done this, but she has increased the debt ceiling for one thing. And I mean, I hear debt ceiling, I think of the U.S. because Congress is always talking about raising their debt ceiling. I did not know we had one in Canada, but we do. And this particular government, we had a debt ceiling that was used to be $1.168 trillion, which is quite a high debt ceiling for a country like Canada. But anyway, that was actually increased 56% in 2021 by this particular government under the Borrowing Authority Act. The Borrowing Authority Act was passed in 2017. Who was our government then? And they had a majority at that time, so there probably wasn't a lot of oversight on this bill. You're going to find that out right away. In 2021, under the guise of pandemic spending, the debt ceiling in Canada was raised by that 56% to $1.831 trillion. And we're on our way there. We are already over 1.2. So I guess good that they increased that debt ceiling so they can keep on borrowing. So through the Borrowing Act and the Financial Administration Act, which that has been around for quite some time, but it has been amended by the current government in charge. The Financial Administration Act, just so you know, is essentially an act that governs, not necessarily governs, but governs the administration of Crown corporations. All right. And despite what some people will tell you, the central bank in Canada is a Crown corporation and has been since 1938, I believe it is. So governance of the Bank of Canada also falls under this Financial Administration Act, which is why, and you've heard this in other medias for sure, and also on this show, that the Bank of Canada annually always funnels its profits into general revenue for the government. That's why, because they are regulated under the Financial Administration Act as a Crown corporation. That's also why, when we've heard this in last year, the Bank of Canada lost money because of government borrowing, because the government had essentially forced them to print more bonds than anybody wanted to buy. I mean, you can only issue so many bonds and force the Bank of Canada to buy them before they start losing money on them. That's what's happened. That's why the Bank of Canada, which usually turns a profit and pours about $1 billion into federal government coffers, is not able to do that this year. Okay. So now that you know these two acts exist, it is under the Borrowing Authority Act that Chrystia Freeland has decided that she wants to make available for her government to spend another $73 billion. Sorry, Bill, I probably should have told you to set your coffee down before I mentioned that, but you might know me well enough by now that you did that already. So our borrowing limit for this year has now increased to $517 billion to be available for borrowing, because she gave it that $73 billion bump. And these outlets are saying, well, what does she need that 73 for? Well, remember that $40 billion pharmacare thing we just talked about? Maybe there's something going on in there. All right. Foreign investors in Canada have been pulling their money out at record paces. In fact, 2023 was a record for foreign investors leaving Canada. $48.7 billion of foreign investment left Canada in 2023 alone. That's a record. $4 billion a month of foreign capital left Canada because foreign investors looked and said, this is just not the place where we're going to make any money. Want to wonder why it is that we've got a recession going on? There's a good reason right there. Okay, so what made me sick to my stomach was I actually was reading through the Financial Administration Act and the Borrowing Authority Act. And of course, I had to take some screenshots because if you don't have your coffee sitting down now, Bill, put it down. You're not going to like what you hear. Okay, so under the Financial Administration Act, governments are able to, well, I guess, create some more money on their own. Let's go to Section 46 of the Financial Administration Act. This is the kind of crap I do. This is why, well, the result of me being politically engaged and active since I was a very, very young kid. I was 8 years old when I actually first became aware of politics in this country. And it's been my jam pretty much ever since. So you can understand why I wasn't very popular with the ladies in high school. I was actually quite political in high school, of all the funny things. So let's go to section 46. 46.1, to be exact, of the Financial Administration Act. You can find this on the Government of Canada website if you choose to. It's definitely a good cure for insomnia. We're just going to skip up to subsection 3 of 46.1. And that is the payment by Her Majesty, which now will be His Majesty, of course, of any amount in extraordinary circumstances. Note, extraordinary circumstances. Pandemic. Including the event of a natural disaster, or to promote the stability or maintain the efficiency of the financial system in Canada, if the minister is of the opinion that the borrowing of money is necessary in those circumstances. That's not a lot of constraint on Chrystia Freeland if she just has to make the case that, yeah, we need to borrow more money, so I'm going to do it. And yes, she does need to have authority from the governor and council. And what the hell is the governor and council? Governor and council is actually not a single person. It's the governor general who gives that okay. But the governor and council, of course, is, well, an appointed council appointed by, well, the governor general and the Privy Council. Privy Council, of course, is... The chief of the Privy Council is the most senior bureaucrat in Canada, appointed by, I know this is going to surprise you folks, appointed by the PMO. The Prime Minister's office appoints the chair of the Privy Council. And it is the Privy Council, the Governor General, and a bunch of other unappointed or unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats who give that rubber stamp to, in this case, Chrystia Freeland, to, well, increase the money supply if she decides she needs to do that. So now let us go over to the Borrowing Authority Act. Now I'm going to just read from Section 4 of said Borrowing Authority Act. And to start off, Section 4 is the maximum amount that may be borrowed. This is where she increased the debt ceiling back in 2021. So it says, despite Section 3 and any other Act of Parliament, but subject to Section 6, which is actually just an exceptions section, the total following amounts must not at any time exceed $1.831 trillion. And we're going to just move down here to say the total amount of money borrowed by the minister under Section 3, the Financial Administration Act, and the borrowing authority listed in the schedule. That's just boring bureaucraties for saying that she can borrow that much money to cover off national debts. And it actually explains in that Section 46 of the Financial Administration Act that the money can be borrowed to pay off government debts for different crown corporations. Provincial debts are also rolled into that as well, or can be. And because that's a lot of provinces borrow money from the feds, right? So now we go to the total amount of money. Okay, so these amounts cannot exceed the $1.8 trillion. Included is total amount of money borrowed by the government, the total amount of money by the way of issue and sale of Canada mortgage bonds that are guaranteed by Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. So, government-backed Canada mortgage and housing bonds. What happens if they can't keep enough money in the supply to back those mortgage bonds? Just ask yourself that question. You want the government buying your house? Oh, did I say that out loud? Whoops. All right, Section C, the total amount of money borrowed by all agent corporations by way of issue and sale of their securities or otherwise, other than amounts that they borrowed from Her Majesty in right of Canada, and other than amounts that they are deemed under any other Act of Parliament to have borrowed. They can play shell games with our money, bouncing back and forth with these two acts. And here's what actually made me sick to my stomach was the exceptions amounts not counting towards the total debt ceiling. I know we're getting into way into the weeds of nerdiness here, Canada, and please just stick with me. I'm almost done the nerd part, and we'll get to the opinion on it later because it bothers me. The following amounts do not, this is Section 5, by the way, of the Borrowing Authority Act. Amounts borrowed by the minister, this is subsection A, amounts borrowed by the minister under an order made under paragraph 46.1, section C, subsection C, we talked about that already, of the Financial Administration Act, other than those borrowed under such an order made during the period of March 2021 and May 2021. That was the pandemic borrowing. That was the reason that she increased the debt ceiling by 56%. So they had to amend that actually in 2021. Subsection B, the amounts borrowed by the minister under an order made under paragraph 46.1 in that act and for the payment of any amount in respect of a debt that was originally incurred by an order made in that act. So when you want to blow out some pandemic spending, you actually don't have to count it in that debt ceiling. Or if the minister decides that, well, hey, you know what, that was that debt was made during COVID times. And that was why she claimed she needed to expand the debt ceiling during COVID times. That also does not have to count toward that debt ceiling. What made me sick to my stomach about that was that I realized after reading through these, this little bit of nerdy wonkery that I just read to you, that it is so easy for this government to just decide to print more money when they want to. All they have to do is get an order in council, like the firearms ban, for example. In this case, get the governor in council to approve, aka the governor general, appointed by who? Right, the prime minister's office. And the clerk of the privy council, appointed by who? Oh, the prime minister's office. And get an agreement from cabinet, appointed by the prime minister. And they can go ahead and increase the money supply all they want. And they can say, nope, this is for a national emergency. This is for some spending that would not normally be utilized. And or this money is needs to be created to cover off national debts from crown corporations. So we could just go ahead and print it. And we don't have to go to Parliament. I mean, that democracy is so messy after all, right? I mean, you all heard Larry Fink from BlackRock Capital talk about that. Democracies are messy. And they don't need it. They don't need democracy. They don't need your consent to increase our debt ceiling. They don't even need Parliament's consent to increase the debt ceiling. They can just say, hey, we need more money and we're going to do this. And they're going to drive this country under using that authority. She just asked for another $73 billion to spend for this year and got it without even having to ask for it in Parliament, just because governor and council said, yeah, okay, go ahead. How much more are they going to spend? What is this next budget going to look like if she's looking for another $73 billion on top of what's already going to be a $46 billion deficit? So sorry I had to read some of that crap to get you through those two government acts, but this is crazy. They can drive us broke. And, well, I guess they're going to. And it's absolutely nuts how easily they can do it. And man, oh man, it makes me sick, but it also makes me understand that the spring election might still be on, folks. I know that a lot of people, when they saw the Jagmeet Singh announcement about PharmaCare, were thinking that, oh, well, now so much for a spring election. He got his way there, you know, they got his PharmaCare, and even said that the legislation might not be in place by March 1st, and it might not be implemented immediately. So he's already backpedaling on, of course, and we knew he would. We knew that he would find some way to back out of it because he's Jagmeet Singh. But I could still see the government saying, yep, we're going to get pharmacare done for Canadians. They're going to present a budget that is going to be absolutely enormous. You can see they're already throwing spending announcements around. Justin Trudeau has been traveling the country, making housing announcements. Remember him, how he was in Edmonton trashing Danielle Smith while making a housing announcement. I think they're going to introduce an absolutely huge budget, which is going to be spend, spend, spend. As the old expression goes, chicken in every pot. And this is how they're doing it. They're doing it by using our own laws against us, really, by increasing the debt ceiling. All right. I got one more thing I want to talk about to wrap the show up with. And this is also personal because it literally happened not very far from my house. Saskatoon has had its fifth homicide of the year. And that's not bad. I mean, if you live in Toronto, you're probably thinking, yeah, big deal. We get that in an afternoon. Okay, not quite that drastic, but I get what you're saying. When I first moved into the city itself, I lived in a small town here before I moved into Saskatoon itself. But back in 2008, I moved into the city itself. There was 5 or 6 murders a year. So we've already matched that by the end of February. What's most disturbing about this, and we don't know a lot of details about it, but I don't need to, because what happened was the victim was 12 years old, a 12-year-old boy. And the perpetrators, who have now been arrested and charged, two perpetrators who are 12 and 13 years old. And I tried to let that sink in, but I can't. A 12-year-old victim murdered by a 12 and 13-year-old perpetrators. How the hell does that happen? I'm absolutely beside myself. How have we allowed ourselves as a society to degrade so badly that a 12-year-old kid is murdered by two other kids his own age? Where did we go wrong? Where did we fall off of the moral train that a 12-year-old thinks, I'm going to kill that guy, and does it? How are we so lost as a country that this happens? That I can't even fathom that. When I was 12 years old, I'm not saying that there weren't people I didn't like, because of course there were. But would I ever have thought of killing somebody when I was 12 years old? I mean, I guess even if I did, would I actually have followed through with it? And there's not a lot of details, of course, because of the age of the victim and the perpetrators. So we'll probably never find out what actually went down. And I don't think I want to be honest. But what I want to understand is, not even where were the parents. That's always the first reaction. Where were the parents here? Well, I don't know that either. But where are we? Where are we as a country that a situation could even get to that? And I know there's been comments since this happened saying, well, we need more programs for kids so they've got ways to channel this energy, and we need to keep kids busy so that they don't turn to crime and drugs, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I hope that at 12 and 13, they're not in the drug scene. I guess that's possible, which again is another indictment on our society, is what the hell are we doing letting kids that young be in that scene. But I'm just stunned that we actually allow that mindset. Like how does a 12 and a 13 year old get into the headspace that I want to kill this kid and we're actually going to do it and they follow through? We've fallen off the rails in society, and well, we've seen it under the watch of this current government that we've fallen apart as a society. We've got a government that divides us, tells us we have no core identity, tells us that we're a post-national state, that we've got no unifying characteristics, nothing that makes us Canadian. Well, in the next sentence saying our universal health care makes us Canadian. We've got a prime minister that divides us daily. You saw in the 2021 election, vaccinated versus unvaccinated, black versus white, indigenous versus white, everybody against white people because white people are the problem, white supremacists, right? And it's rural versus urban. It's everybody against Muslims. It's everybody against Jews now with the Israel thing. It's Christians against Sikhs. It's you name it. This government has chosen anything it can possibly get its hands on to divide this country and to divide people against each other. And it has only been the good of Canadians and just the true good nature and good hearts of our citizens that have kept us together. And then this happens. And you say, these are kids. These are kids who, I don't know, you'd think might be out chasing girls or chasing boys at 12 and 13. But no, they're killing each other instead. And I just can't get my head around that, no matter how hard I try. So something's got to change. We've talked before earlier in the show about, you know, citizens at the local level affecting change and in some cases stopping it in the case of land use bylaws. And I guess that's where it's got to go. That's where we've got to make this happen. We've got to make some changes because I don't want to lose, in this case, 3 12 and 13 year olds, because the 12 and 13 year old who murdered a 12 year old, try saying that twice, their lives are ruined. They're going to get 3 years in juvie and then be back out in society. Let that sink in, because that one really hurts. So I'm just going to leave it there, Canada. Sorry to editorialize at the end of the show, but I just cannot get my head around that one. And if someone's willing, able to explain to me how that even happens in a free, open, and democratic society like this country is supposed to be, how we've gotten to hate each other that much that kids that young are doing that to each other, help me out, because I just don't get it. All right. I'm going to wrap it up there, Canada. Thank you for letting me editorialize that at the end of the show, because that's been bugging me all week. So until next week, thank you so much for joining us. Lewis will be back next week. And until then, it's Tony in Saskatchewan. Good night, Canada.